So, the Buddhadasa school. One way to think of this, and I'm going to start out the easiest way, is there's a very, very ancient Indian philosopher who was in the school called Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna came to a king, and he said to the king, you know, there is no such thing as the self. And the king said, what do you mean? And he said, well, look at your carriage. Does your carriage exist? And then the king said, of course it exists. It's right over there. And Nagarjuna said, well, where is that carriage? Point to it. And he said, well, it's right over there. And he points in the general direction. And Nagarjuna said, okay, suppose we remove the front two wheels. Would your carriage still be there? And the king said, well, of course. It just would be without the front two wheels. And Nagarjuna said, okay, suppose we remove the back two wheels. The king said, well, it's still there. It's now a carriage without wheels, but it's still there. And piece by piece, Nagarjuna removed the seats, the place where the, I don't know anything about carriages, but you get the idea. He removed piece by piece of the carriage, and the king could not point to any one place that was the core of the carriage. You see what I'm saying? The carriage was just a conglomeration of things, but where its essence was undeterminable. You could get rid of parts of it until it virtually wasn't there, and still the king would believe that his carriage was there, until there was one point when suddenly he said, oh wait, it's gone, because there was only a few pieces left. But the time that his carriage had disappeared, he had no idea. He could not point to any place that the carriage, which provided the essence of the carriage. Now, you might want to look at another example of this, which was done by a philosopher named David Hume in the 18th century. It's a very similar one. David Hume said, suppose you have a boat, and you're going to replace the boat piece by piece with identical parts, identical masts, identical, you know, somebody give me a part of a boat. Hull. you know, identical cabins. At what point would this boat be a different boat? You're replacing it piece by piece with identical parts. So at a certain point, the boat's going to be an entirely different, yet exactly the same replica of what it was once. So it's a different boat. But is there any point that you could say when the boat was the same boat and when it was a different boat? No, you can't. These are some of the relativistic exercises or thought experiments that these types of philosophers and Buddhists offer. The same goes for what we call ourselves. Now, it seems like the sense of what I am, what you are, is pretty given. You tend to have a good idea of who you are, right? You walk around, oh, I know what I am. But it's interesting, in different cultures and amongst the peoples of different cultures, there are radically different ideas of who we are. For example, a dancer will have a very strong sense of their identity being part of their body. But there are people who don't use their bodies, who don't view their bodies as a core part of their self or their identity. There are some cultures where the family is considered to be very much a part of somebody's identity. So that if a patriarch in some cultures, if his daughter marries off somebody who he thinks is inappropriate or from a different religion, there can be enormous repercussions because he thinks his self has been attacked, his reputation. Some people consider their reputations to be part of who they are. Some people don't care what other people think about them. Some people can wake up one day and have a very shrunken sense of who they are, and then the next day we can have a much more expansive sense of our identity. It changes. And then, not only is this the idea of self change, but what we constitute ourselves to be can change. At one point in our life, we can view ourselves as being very open-minded, and then in other parts of our lives, we can view ourselves as being rather set in our ways. Some people, we can view ourselves as experimental, and then we can go in phases where we define ourselves as rather defined, and rather on a set path. So how we define ourselves and what constitutes ourselves is constantly changing. And this school of Buddhists maintains that the reason this happens is the Father. There's a great quote that the Buddha started out his teachings with, Manopubanga Dhamma. Manopubanga Dhamma, Manayasa Manaya. Wait, is that it? Manopubanga Dhamma. I always get this quote wrong, and I shouldn't because I tend to. Where are you? Manopubanga Dhamma, Manosetta Manomaya. Thank you for catching me on that. what that means is that the mind is the author of all things. Everything we experience is represented in the mind. There's nothing that we've ever experienced in our life that is exactly as the way it's out there. Everything that we experience has been radically, radically altered. As neuroscientists say, we basically have little virtual reality machines in our heads that represent the world to us. We don't actually see what we experience as the world. We create it in our minds. Some neuroscientists in the New York Times claimed it was less than 3% of the visual field we actually see. The rest, 97% of what you think you're seeing, has actually been created for you by this virtual reality machine in your brain. One neuroscientist, Rick Hansen, says our virtual realities we live in are only close enough to the real reality that we don't bump into the furniture, and that's it. But we're all living in our own perceptions, our own virtual realities, and one of the first things we do in this virtual reality machine is we create this sense of who am I and who I am not. Where do I begin and end, and where does the rest of the world begin and end? The Buddha taught a great practitioner. There was a guy named Bahiya, who was very revered throughout his time. But Bahiya, when he heard of the Buddhist teachings, he said, oh my God, fuck, I'm not enlightened. This guy knows more than me. He was a really smart guy, and he had a lot of followers, but he knew he hadn't gotten to the pinnacle enlightened part. He hadn't gotten to it. He went to the Buddha and he said, what am I missing? What am I missing? What's that one piece of the puzzle that I haven't figured out? And the Buddha said, when you learn to see what you've seen, hear what you've heard, think what you've thought, without adding any sense of you into it, you'll have been enlightened. And it said that right after hearing that, Bahiya got enlightened and then was killed instantly by a cow. That's true. I love that story. The Buddha gave him the award in the quickest to what? The quickest to be enlightened. The quickest to be enlightened, Bahiya. It's the simple saying that the Buddha taught him was, when you see what's seen, hear what's heard, without adding a sense of you into it, out there in the world, or in here, or anywhere in between, the Buddha said. There's no you. There's no you. Another time the Buddha said, the moment we create the you, the sense of I-ness, is the exact same moment we create the world. They are the twin polar agreements of each other. For example, if I take this piece of paper and I split it in half, the moment I create the sense of I, I'm creating the sense of the world. And the moment I create the world, I'm creating the sense of who I am. And the reason that's important is the moment you create a sense of who you are, that's when you immediately start what the Buddha called paticca-samuppada, this idea that this you that's different from everything out there, even though it's all created by the same mind, this you has got to go out there and get the things you need so that you'll be happy and safe and secure. It creates this artificial division. It's artificial because, again, everything you've ever experienced, you've experienced in your own mind. You're the one who's creating this artificial division of where you end and where the world begins. And you create this feeling, because there's this division there, that there's something missing from you that has to come from out there. Now you're seeing this is pretty dense teaching. It's pretty abstract. It's not the easiest way to throw people into the Dhamma, but it is pretty heady stuff. And this is why the Buddhadasa school is one of the more interesting, fun schools to teach every once in a while. I would never teach this way all the time, because I'd have people that would be walking around like they've taken a lot of acid, and they wouldn't know, you know, what's up from down. But it's a good exercise to occasionally think this way, to think in terms of, oh, okay, the moment I start creating this sense of what's happening to me, what's mine, what I'm all about, what my story is, I'm at that very instant creating at the same time all these things that are not me. And these things I'm also creating that are not me are the places I'm going to be looking and trying to control to give me all the things I feel are not complete within me. Now, of course, there's nothing that's incomplete about you. The thing that makes you feel incomplete, the thing that makes you feel like there's something missing, is the fact that you have divided up the world into what's me and what's not me. Woo, it's pretty trippy stuff. I love this stuff. It's fun. I've read a lot of it and studied with a lot of these guys, and it's a difficult thing to wrap your head around. But as we go through it next week, I'm going to take you to the outer reaches of Buddhism and teach you the concepts of Tathāgata, Sunyata, the empty void behind all things, Tathāgata, the suchness that's out there but you cannot actually reach. And finally, Atamyata, the way the mind grasps and turns itself into the world and the way to escape doing that. Now finally, before I turn it over to you guys, I have to say that in the chain of Paticca-samuppada, where the Buddha talks about how this sense of I-ness develops, he says, and I'm going to do this very briefly, he says that we start out with this ignorance of the way the mind works and that it's creating this sense of I, and that it basically, we start the search for the sense of completeness or the sense of happiness out there. We make contact with the world, and when we do, we go through a series of perceptual steps. The first is when we make contact with the world, we get a gut feeling of whether or not we like what we made contact with or we don't like it. This is called Vedana. And Vedana comes in like and don't like. I like what I made contact with. It's going to be good with me. Or I don't like it, or I don't care about it at all, either way. Now, after this Vedana stage, we go through the stage of craving, if we like it, and then craving is an appetite for it. We want it. We start thinking about how to get it. And then clinging. Clinging is where we've actually got it. And clinging, the word the Buddha used for clinging is upadana, which means feed. The mind, it's feeding off the world. It's feeding off of senses and things and people. That's what we're doing when we cling to something. We're feeding off of it. What are we feeding off of it? We're feeding off of it looking for that sense of wholeness and completeness and that sense of being safe that has simply come about because of that forgetfulness of the way the mind has created all of our problems. So we're looking for something that is not really a problem, the solution to the problem that's not really there. So anyway, the Buddha said, though, when we start feeding off of the world, that's when we start the real storytelling, building up the real sense of who we are, our life story, because as we suckle on the world and it goes away and we fight, we really develop this sense of biography, autobiography, and who am I, who am I not. The problem is that you can't attack it directly. The Buddha said that while all of this is fascinating, trying to stop yourself telling your story directly, trying to get rid of your sense of I, is not going to work because you're too addicted to it. It's too late. He said the only way in this chain that you can break the cycle of creating suffering, creating the sense of self, this sense of I that's very alone in the world and separated from the thing it needs, is by stopping earlier at the stage called Vedana. Stopping where you've got that felt sense of like and don't like. Find the part of the body that's reacting to life with either being relaxed or stressful, a sense of building up tension in the body, and sit with that. Sit with the felt sense, but don't go beyond that. The moment he said you go into craving and then clinging, and then the next stage of that is bhava, becoming. You've literally taken on a new identity. And that, with that comes all the stress and suffering. Birth, life, death, horrible things. So, because every identity you take in life is going to come to an end and it's going to involve a lot of suffering. You might say, well, I'm a doctor, I'm an artist, I'm a painter, I'm a nurse, I'm a this, I'm a that. But no matter what you call yourself, no matter what identity you take on, eventually it's going to end. And when it ends, it's going to cause you pain and suffering. Best not to take on, the Buddha said, any identities. Don't define yourself. Don't take on a role. Because when you do, that's where stress and suffering is. So my goal tonight was to really trip you out, and I think I've succeeded. I've never seen a look of more astonishment mixed with, what the fuck was that all about? Which is good. I've done my job. I'm not always here to give you the easy way through the Dhamma. Sometimes I'm here to really mess with your minds. And you can never tell when you come here. I'm never going to give you advance warning. I am going to give you advance warning that next week's going to be a real mindfucker. But then after that, I'm going back to the simple Dhamma of like ways to work with obsessive thoughts and stuff like that. So you only have one more week of the trippy stuff. So thank you for listening, and now it's your turn. All right.
So you're talking about the